Hello, everybody. Jeff,
are
you with us today as well?
Yes.
I'd like to introduce my co-host, Jeff Wilson from Brisbane.
Good evening, everyone.
Jeff's the the president-elect of the International Academy of Family Lawyers Asia Pacific, and I'm the president. And it gives us real pleasure today to say hello to everybody. There are now 71 of you online, and I think we have as many as 330 odd who have registered. So that must be a record for somebody. Jeff?
No, it's fabulous. I join with you, Corinne, and certainly welcoming all of our colleagues from Law Asia, those connected with World Congress, and also our fellows from the IAFL, and particularly our Asia Pacific chapter members. I don't know, Corinne, if you're aware, I've been involved with the IAFL, IAML now for a long time, and I've been involved with the outreach committee. And it's certainly been a long-term goal of ours to work together, particularly with Law Asia. We're well placed, obviously, in the Asia Pacific region to be working together. So I'm excited about this evening and looking forward to not only tonight, but future events where we can work together. Yeah. And certainly there's a crossover amongst our membership of those who are fellows with the IAFL as well as members of Law Asia. Can I say to those who have joined us from Law Asia who are not fellows of the IAFL, we would welcome the opportunity for you to contact us, contact Corinne or myself or any of your colleagues in your country who are fellows with a view to joining us. And likewise, I think for those of us who are not members of Law Asia, I'd certainly encourage that we join with Law Asia. And I look forward, obviously, to future opportunities. But tonight, a lot of work has gone into this, Corinne. I can see the numbers are probably testament to that.
Yeah, Jeff, actually, I was looking at the missions of the three organisations and really, also, we would encourage members to think about joining World Congress as well. Our IAFL is connecting colleagues, cultivating knowledge and creating solutions. And I looked at Law Asia's mission and they were connecting the legal profession in the Asia Pacific region. They're the voice of the legal profession and they're a conduit for encouraging an adherence to mutually held principles. So that's pretty much in alignment with what we're doing. Then I looked at World Congress and they're to enhance, promote and protect human rights of children and young people and to bring together individuals and organisations from across the world who have influence in the legal and judicial system. So here we are, three of us, organisations working together, collaborating together, thanks to all the efforts that have gone on over the last few weeks. That's amazing. And 330 people to be coming today for that.
Yeah, certainly we welcome everybody aboard. It's probably a good opportunity to bring Malapi and Diana in now as our co-moderators this evening and hand over to them.
Yep. But before we hand over, I'd like to just say that this would not have happened but for the collaborative effect of Nigel Nichols from IAFL, T.L. Yap of Law Asia and Sally Nichols of World Congress. So we've all worked together to put this, make this happen today. And it's strange, if I could just quote Malati, it's a pandemic that brought us together despite the fact that none of us can travel. And webinars are the way forward, I think, in future. So just a quick word about tonight's format. There's 1.5 hours, not the normal 1 hour that IAFL normally has for its happy hours. And the first hour will be led by Malati Das, and she will then pass on to Diana in the last 30 minutes, which will be Q&A. All of this will be starting off with nobody seen apart from the panelists. But in the last half an hour, if you would electronically raise your hand, and you do that by going to the participants, we now have 107. If you go click participants, you can see raise hand. If you click raise hand, then we will arrange for you to be seen in the last half an hour, and you can participate not only as a listener, but as a person who can ask questions. So without more ado, unless Jeff, you have anything to say, can I pass it on to Milan?
No, I think it's...
Yeah?
Thanks.
Yeah. Milati, over to you.
Great. thank you, Corinne and Jeff. And in case anyone's wondering why it's sounding a bit wet coming from my side, it's because it's storming out here in Singapore. So I apologize for the background noise. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to everyone, wherever you're Zooming in from. As Corinne and Jeff have introduced me, I'm Malathi Das. I am an IFFL fellow from Singapore. I'm also a past Law Asia president, and I'm also a life member of AWARE, a leading women's rights and gender equality group in Singapore. Ahead of 25th November, which is the United Nations International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, it is my pleasure to co-moderate today's multidisciplinary and multi-jurisdictional joint webinar on When Home is Where the Violence Is, the Pandemic Paradox, where we are hoping to weave together the themes of domestic violence and family law with the infamous star of 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic, and provide a jurisdictional perspective from Asia and Australasia and the Pacific, covering Japan, Singapore, Hong Kong, Fiji, as well as Australia. With the various experts on our panel today, we hope to provide a rich and multidimensional discussion on the role of family lawyers, activists, community agencies, academia, and law enforcement in tackling the challenges of domestic violence in these unprecedented times. I know Corinne has covered this, but just in case people have joined us since the start, can I also just quickly say that apart from a brief introduction to each speaker, we will be asking speakers to give us their 10 minutes to touch on the area of expertise on this topic. You as audience are encouraged to type your questions in the Q&A box, or also ask your questions during the open Q&A session that will be moderated by my dear friend, Diana Bryan. Audience will also be invited to join in with your videos and to join in with your videos on and to ask your questions live if you prefer. Now let's get on with the show. The reason why we've chosen this topic today is because we are all involved in family law, and I understand that we have over now 100 friends dialing in from IAFL, Law Asia, and the World Congress. Family law is, in my view, living law that impacts everyone's lives, and regardless of whether or not you were ever involved in a family dispute, by the very fact that we are all members of a family, often in different capacities, it is relevant to us. I hope this webinar will also see its particular relevance during an unprecedented global pandemic like COVID-19. As I'm sure you have read our experts' bios, in the interest of discussion time, I hope you and they don't mind me skipping in the details. To kick us off, we have our first panelist, an IFL fellow from Japan, family lawyer Ayako Ikeda, who is an international family lawyer and also a member of the Family Law Committee of the Japan Federation of Bar Associations. Ayako will share the challenges faced in Japan as a result of COVID and its impact on domestic violence. Ayako, over to you.
Hello, this is Ayako Ikeda, IAFL member from Japan. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to make a presentation on Japanese situations on the domestic violence during COVID-19. I'd like to share my PowerPoint present. Okay. Can you see it? Can you see my PowerPoint presentation? Can you see?
Yes, please go ahead, Ayako. Okay. We can see it.
Okay. So, yeah. So, domestic violence and COVID-19 in Japan. Well, we had a quasi-lockdown in April and May. In Japan, we had a quasi-lockdown at that time. State of emergency was declared on April 7, 2020, and initially it was until May 6, but extended until May 25th. And the quasi-lockdown it's not compulsory, but strongly requested to stay home. And it was without penalty. And schools were closed down and public facilities were closed. And bar association building was also closed for public. I'm sorry. And at that time, court hearing dates were canceled indefinitely. But there were exceptions. Hague abduction cases, domestic violence cases, habeas corpus cases, and also civil provisional remedy cases and other urgent cases on child custody, civil enforcement and bankruptcy cases are continued. And at that time, number of domestic violence consultation increased. There is a statistic of Cabinet Office about consultation at the local government level and Cabinet Office consultation level. In 2019, they have consultation 10,000 to 11,000 per month. But in 2020, the number was 15,000 to 18,000. So in May 2020 and July 2020, there was a 60% increase. And after that, 40% increase compared to 2019. We have an Act on the Prevention of Spousal Violence and the Protection of Victims. The law was enacted 2001 and amended a few times. And violence includes not only bodily harm, but also psychological and sexual violence. But the protection orders apply only to bodily harm or life-threatening intimidation. We have an explanation sheet in English about our system of this law. And victims can go to either the police or spousal violence counseling and support centers, it's called SV centers, or women's counseling offices. And they will give the temporary protection. Spousal violence counseling and support centers are set in each prefecture. And they offer consultation, counseling, temporary protection for victims and accompanying family members, and also give them various information. Temporary protection, women's consultation offices in each prefecture give them the temporary protection, and victims can live in safety for short periods together with their children if applicable. And sometimes this was done in coordination with private shelters and other organizations. And more longer time period, the law provides protection orders. And there are several kind of orders. Order prohibiting approach to the victim, or order prohibiting phone calls to the victim, or order to vacate. And such protection orders will be made by petition. And you know, this part, you know, the family lawyers will assist. And the consultation with the police or SV center is virtually necessary to make this petition. And legal aid is available for this petition. As you may know, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres made a statement in April 2020, and he said, make the prevention and redress of violence against women a key part of national response plan for COVID-19. And he advised to increase investment in online services and civil society organizations, and making sure judicial systems continue to prosecute abusers, and setting up emergency warning systems in pharmacies and groceries, and declare shelters as essential services, and creating safe ways for women to seek support without alerting their abusers. Well, in response to such statement, Japanese government focuses on DV counseling and protection of victims. They newly created DV Counseling Plus. And this is a 24-hour, 7 days a week telephone consultation service. And also SNS and email with 10 foreign languages. Also chat from 12 o'clock to 10 o'clock in the evening is available. And SV Center will provide information to such phone call. We, Japan Federation of Bar Associations, our president made a statement on April 17th, 2020, and calling for preventing domestic violence associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. And he referred to UN Secretary General's statement and requested government to make further to take further measures. The further measures recommended by JFBA, Japan Federation Bar Associations, were as follows. Setting up more shelters and securing financial resources to implement support and services for DV victims, and provide necessary temporary protection promptly, and looking more intently into DV cases, and also ensuring post-relocation livelihood support. And the JFBA, this is the Federation of Bar Associations, and we have, this is the Federation of Bar Associations, and bar associations have, we have 52 bar associations in Japan, and both organizations will contribute efforts of government by creating legal counseling services related to COVID-19 outbreak through phone or online, and address issues of domestic violence and abuse. And our efforts are continuing. Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking us off on a very good start with such a concise and comprehensive summary, Ayako. It's good to see that, you know, I think some of the examples that you have given us are also shared, I think, around the world. I'd like to move on to our next speaker, who is from Singapore. Corina Lim is a former lawyer and is now Executive Director of Gender Equality and Advocacy Group AWARE, or the Association of Women for Action and Research. As we all know, with COVID-19 and lockdowns, for many, home also became the workplace, as well as schools for families. Corina will talk about domestic violence from the angle of how we can get employers, including law firms, to be part of the solution to addressing family violence. Her 10 minutes will address COVID, what volunteers saw at the AWARE helpline in Singapore, and what employers can do about it. Over to you, Corina.
Thank you. So AWARE is an NGO that started in 1985. We have a long history of working on family domestic violence issues. We run the one and only women's helpline in Singapore, and this helpline is the easiest way for women to get help on family, workplace, and emotional issues. About 25% of our calls dealt with family violence and other domestic issues. We also offer counseling, legal clinics, and support groups to callers who need these services. And we have been working also at the law and policy level and have been instrumental in getting greater protection for survivors in Singapore against family violence. Domestic violence. Now, Singapore, like many other countries, and as Ayako has shared in Japan as well, we went into lockdown mode in the earlier part of the year. People were required to work from homes, and calls to the women's helpline during that period, March to May, went through the roof. Domestic violence calls increased by 137% at its highest. That was in May. As an organization, we responded by setting up extra lines and also launched a new chat service for women who could not call us safely from their homes. So we arranged to chat with them instead at appointed times. So why was this happening? As you can guess, there was greater stress and friction in families as people had to spend 24 hours, 7 days a week in confined spaces. Singapore is a small country. We live in fairly small flats, most of us. So that was pressure that we didn't used to have. But as many of you who practice family law know, family violence is more than just about, you know, stress and tension and conflict between couples or between family members. It is really about the exertion of control by one party over another. And as people felt their world spiraling out of control in ways that they could not foresee, anticipate because of COVID, they felt the need perhaps to control the people that they could control. Right. And so that manifested in some cases in more family violence. Everyone was also working from home, so they were in close proximities, which meant that the opportunities to control another party was also increased. So this was a sad and difficult situation, but to every thunderstorm, and we are having one in Singapore right now, there is a silver lining. In this case, it was that people and companies in particular in Singapore started to take an interest in this topic. and to realize that family violence was not just a domestic issue, but also a workplace issue. So what work from home did was that it effectively erased the line between work and home. If domestic violence affected someone at home, it had a direct impact on their work productivity. So we saw companies start to think about this and to roll out domestic violence policies for the first time in Singapore. So I think many of you come from countries where this is actually already being practiced, right? Companies having domestic violence policies, but in Singapore, this is actually very new. So for the first time, AWARE was asked and invited to give corporate talks and workshops, and we ended up training hundreds of employees on recognizing domestic violence in the workplace. And the approach that we used was the well-known 3R approach. So thankfully, you know, there's precedence in places like Australia, UK, and Canada. So the recognize, respond, and refer approach was what we use. We taught employees and companies how to recognize domestic violence, how to respond with empathy and support to a colleague without being overly intrusive or in any way judgmental about parties. And also to refer their colleagues to resources that are available to domestic violence victims in Singapore. So it really was a breakthrough moment for Singapore, right? This idea that domestic violence is a workplace issue. And we have seen the corporate solution to domestic violence to be an important one. For people who experience domestic violence on a regular basis, the workplace, when they have to go to work, has actually been a safe refuge, even if the workplace itself was not conscious of this fact. And the studies from Canada have shown that many people who experience violence do in fact talk to their colleagues about their abusive situation. A Canadian survey showed that more than 43% of those experiencing family domestic violence reported that they discussed it with someone at work, usually with co-workers, but sometimes to their managers as well. So colleagues are really very important, natural first responders to people who experience violence. And as we all know, that first response can be a make or break response. If you get a negative first response that says, no, either dismissing this or suggesting that it's something that might be your fault, then you may not go further to get help. But if you get someone who says is very empathetic and actually might refer you to some resources that can give you professional support, that could actually put you on the path of healing, recovery, and possibly, if necessary, reporting the violence. A large number of the people who call our helpline do so because their friends tell them to do so. It is usually not the first person or telephone number that they think of calling. They are referred by their friends. We also find the converse. Many people don't seek help because their friends were not supportive or judged them negatively when they shared with their friends about their abusive relationship. So first responder training has gone a long way. Some companies have also gone further. They have implemented and rolled out emergency leave, emergency cash, and emergency accommodation programs for people who are suffering from this. They're offering counseling service. They are making it safe for people to talk about this. So when we come in to do a lunchtime talk, and perhaps someone from the company also shares their experience as a survivor or as a bystander, it makes it safe for other people to actually talk about it. So the workplace then really effectively is an important part of the solution to domestic violence. So while the violence is still quite high, not as high as during the lockdown in Singapore, but it is still high and we still maintain the services, the additional services we rolled out. We are also glad for this development, and we hope that companies will continue to respond to domestic violence and support their staff on it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Corina. That was a very interesting perspective, I think, looking at it from the point of view of how employers and how we as law firms, being employers ourselves, can address this issue. We're now going to change track a little bit and move to the topic of children. Now, children are often the bystanders, if not directly involved, when family violence rears its ugly head. And during the pandemic, are probably even more likely to be silent or not so silent witnesses to it, as home-based learning became the norm for many during lockdown. Anne Scully, our next speaker, is a many-hatted mediator, lecturer, and researcher. She is currently adjunct professor with the Chinese University of Hong Kong, and she will share with us the impact that the pandemic has had on children in particular, and how the children's voice needs to be heard in issues dealing with family violence. Anne is well placed to do this, having recently completed an 18-month research project commissioned by the Hong Kong Committee for Children's Rights on the implementation of the UNCRC Article 12 in Hong Kong. Over to you, Anne.
Thanks, Malati. Hello, everyone. So today I'm going to talk about how domestic violence during COVID has been affecting children in Hong Kong. And the first question I'll address is what steps were taken to support victims of domestic violence and their children at risk during the closure period in Hong Kong. Looking at government first, a number of the government departments I contacted to find out what had been done in anticipation of a surge in domestic violence, including the Departments of Health, Justice and Constitutional Affairs, replied saying that this wasn't their remit and I should contact the Social Welfare Department. The first thing I want to say is that this silo mentality in government strikes me as problematic. Without a cross-government response, the likelihood of effectively addressing domestic violence in any given society at any time, let alone during a crisis, is, I would think, significantly diminished. The Social Welfare Department itself responded saying that it had maintained its services, but had often switched those services to online delivery or telephone delivery, and that where it had maintained open spaces such as refuges and counselling centres, that they had created safe hygiene spaces for clients, and that in particular emergency statutory procedures were maintained at all times. Hong Kong's had a lot of school closures over the last 12 months because of the protests, but particularly during the pandemic, there was school closure. And the Education Bureau responded to me that it had worked with the Social Welfare Department to ensure that at-risk children continue to receive support by online or telephone methods during the school closures from both school social workers, whose numbers have been recently increased, happily, by the government and their teachers. The Hong Kong police reported back that they had maintained their existing procedures in relation to domestic violence call-outs. Though one NGO reported that its victims had found that certain procedures that had previously been in place, such as interviewing parties separately in the home and handing out information on support services to potential victims, were not being fulfilled. But we don't know why that was and how widespread that was at this time. In terms of legal remedies, the courts were closed for a period of general adjournment from late January through to early May, but remained able to hear domestic violence applications and any other urgent applications through a duty judge scheme. And in fact, a second duty judge was made available in case of a significant increase in domestic violence applications. Some practitioners noted during the general adjournment period that adapting to the use of technology to conduct court business was somewhat patchy, though some judges were engaging in remote hearings and accepting email. looking at the NGOs in Hong Kong, it's important to note that social services are delivered in Hong Kong partly directly by the Social Welfare Department and also indirectly through subvention to various NGOs. The NGOs I spoke to reported switching a lot of their delivery from face-to-face to online and telephone services. Some created videos to promote good pandemic parenting tips and messages. One family-related NGO found through its hotline that stresses around hygiene and PPE were a significant cause of family conflict, and so raised funds to provide PPE and hygiene products to families. I should add here that where the violence is situational and triggered by particular stresses in the pandemic, that this kind of intervention can help. But as Corinna said when in her talk earlier, if the violence is coercive controlling, then we may need a more fundamental adjustment than a simple band-aid. I don't want to diminish what was done, but that dealing with the particular here and now may not be enough in an ongoing sense. NGO Refuges for Women remained open, although some women reported preferring to stay at home given the close living circumstances of most refugees. But happily in Hong Kong, a recent innovation has been a Hong Kong hotel chain working with the Social Welfare Department to provide hotel rooms for short stay safe space accommodation for women and their children. So if those were some of the steps that were taken, the question now arises, was there actually a surge in domestic violence in Hong Kong? And the reason I raise this is because I went in assuming, much like many of other jurisdictions around the world, that there would have been a surge. But in Hong Kong, it seems it depends who you ask. The Social Welfare Department keeps statistics on domestic violence and child abuse, and they told me that their record showed absolutely no statistical evidence of an increase in domestic violence during the pandemic period. And instead, the statistics showed a downturn. Similarly, the police reported a drop in domestic violence-related call-outs. No analysis was offered for this finding, but again, as in Singapore, Hong Kongers live in very small homes, and it is possible that the ability to find any privacy to make any call for support or help was greatly inhibited. The judiciary also, anecdotally, I have to say, found no surge in applications for domestic violence injunctions. And in fact, the extra resources provided were not needed. This was confirmed by the majority of lawyers I spoke to, that they hadn't experienced any greater demand in their practice either. Though I should say here that take up for legal remedies for domestic violence in Hong Kong is traditionally low, with only about 40-ish injunctions being awarded each year, which is low given that the Social Welfare Department reports on average about 3,000 incidents each year. So when we look at NGOs, their response is more varied. However, two leading family violence NGOs reported a significant increase in calls to them during the lockdown period. Harmony House, a leading domestic violence NGO, reported a 9% increase year on year. And Against Child Abuse, a child protection NGO, reported between a 25% and 50% monthly increase year on year during the lockdown. Significant rise in calls for help. Interestingly, when a child-led NGO, Kids Dream, surveyed children as to what their main concerns were during the pandemic, they listed falling behind in education, not being able to go out and play, chances of infection, but did not address family violence at all. Which again goes to that notion, as Malati mentioned in the introduction, that children are silent or become invisible, that they're not encouraged to speak out about conflict in the home. So given the disparity between government, legal and NGO experiences of domestic violence during the lockdown period, can we say anything meaningful about how children have been affected? Well, it's possible from NGO feedback to identify certain hotspots, and one is parental supervision of children's education online at home. This has been a cause of stress for parents, and this can trigger conflict and violence in the home. And this has to be seen particularly in the context of Hong Kong, where there is extreme pressure within the family setting on children's academic attainment. In poorer families, this stress has been exacerbated by the fact that there will routinely be no computer at home, and children can access classes online only through a parent's phone. Moreover, unlimited Wi-Fi will be too expensive for the parents, and therefore Wi-Fi is often used up before the children's needs are met. Child poverty in Hong Kong is considerable, with something like 200,000 children out of a million children in Hong Kong, roughly, going to bed each day without having had enough to eat. So poverty as an exacerbating factor in the way that children experience domestic violence is significant in Hong Kong. On the flip side, NGOs also reported the problem of too much unsupervised internet access, which puts children at risk of online grooming, seeing inappropriate material. Children could be left at home during the time when parents had to go out to work if they could not work from home, and this put children at risk. Despite the courts being open for emergency hearings, the general adjournment period has meant that procedures, for example, freeing children for adoption, have been delayed, thus extending the time that an at-risk child spends waiting for a resolution to their current situation. And children usually in Hong Kong will have no separate representation available to support them in that matter. During the general adjournment, where a child would have had the chance to express their views on cases that affect them, either by meeting with a judge or through a social worker, this has been delayed, or contact may be online. And this latter possibility risks the fact that children may be watched, coached, overseen by potentially abusive parents. Until we mainstream the requirement to provide children with the skills and self-belief to express their views, children will remain vulnerable to abuse, whether in times of pandemic or otherwise. So in conclusion, to sum up, I would say that the Hong Kong experience for children during COVID has been that there has been a general absence of recourse to the law, which impacts adversely on children. Existing inequalities have exacerbated some children's experience of family conflict during the pandemic, and the pandemic has largely rendered children silent in the face of conflict in their homes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anne. That was such an insightful presentation and really is giving us a lot of food for thought. And maybe questioning some assumptions that we have for countries that we assume are actually quite well-developed. We're now moving on to the other part of the world, so to speak, to the Pacific. And joining us from Fiji is Atika Singh. Atika is the team leader, Gender and Transitional Justice Program at the Fiji Women's Rights Movement. And in her 10 minutes, she will try and share its research findings, outlining the barriers that women have faced when assessing formal justice systems during the COVID-19 response period. Over to you, Atika.
Thank you, Malathi. So as Malathi mentioned, I'll be basically talking about the barriers experienced by Fijian women in accessing formal justice during the COVID response period. In Fiji, after the first confirmed case of COVID-19 in March, we saw various measures being taken to contain the spread of the virus. This included lockdowns, curfews, social distancing measures, together with our courts operating at reduced capacity and law enforcement officers working around the clock. While this was taking place, communities in Fiji experienced added pressures in terms of dealing with this new routine, which suddenly became the new normal. Marginalized communities and vulnerable groups that includes diverse women and girls tend to experience a higher degree of impact on their livelihood and well-being during crisis situations. So my presentation will basically outline the background of the organization which I am from, the Fiji Women's Rights Movement. Domestic violence situation in Fiji prior to COVID-19, the impact of COVID-19 on the domestic violence trends in Fiji, together with the findings from FWRM's research on Fijian women's access to justice during COVID-19 response period. To begin with, FWRM is established in 1986. Our organization is a multi-ethnic and multi-cultural non-governmental organization committed to removing all forms of discrimination against women through institutional reform and attitudinal change through targeted research and advocacy. FWRM's work in the area of women's access to justice began in 1991, and it resulted in the successful lobby and campaign for the current Family Law Act. FWRM conducted a scoping study aimed at identifying the barriers faced by women in accessing the formal justice system in 2015. And in 2017, we published a summary research report titled Balancing the Scales, Improving Fijian Women's Access to Justice, which found that despite progressive legislations in the country, women continue to face barriers in accessing formal justice. And these barriers include cost, distance, and complexity, particularly in terms of the lack of awareness of the formal justice sector agencies and societal norms and beliefs. FWRM continues to work in this area, particularly in researching on improving women's access to justice during the COVID-19 pandemic. See, the global average of intimate partner violence and or sexual violence for women is 30%. In a study conducted by Fiji Women's Crisis Center in Fiji, states that 64% of Fijian women have physically and or sexually been abused by their intimate partners. So considering Fiji's prevalence rates of physical and or sexual intimate partner violence is much higher than the global statistics, with 10 women being killed by their intimate partners last year, it can be said that domestic violence is already a grave social issue in Fiji. In a recent assessment published by FWRM on women's access to justice during COVID-19 pandemic, found that while support service provider Fiji Women's Crisis Center, which facilitates the National Domestic Violence Helpline, received high number of calls from women experiencing domestic violence, the same did not translate to the women reporting the matter to the police or initiating DVRO, that is the domestic violence restraining order applications in the court. This is very much similar to what Corina had mentioned in terms of NGOs receiving increased number of calls, as well as what Professor Anne had mentioned in terms of not for police officers or law enforcement to not be recording, or there's not recording of a high number of incidences. So the National Domestic Helpline recorded a total of 795 calls for the months of January to April, alone, with the majority of calls being made by women reporting gender-based violence due to the restrictions in movement and economic strains on families. The same did not translate to women reporting increase of domestic violence cases by 12%. For the period of the lockdown, which is 19th March to 14th April, with a slight increase in the reporting of cases upon the implementation of the nationwide curfew. The assessment also did an analysis of the data from Fiji Judiciary and found that for the year of 2020, from January to May, in comparison to previous years, there had been a decrease in domestic violence restraining order applications being initiated. There are various reasons for the lack of reporting and initiating applications for DVROs. And this could be such as being dependent on the perpetrator, being confined in the same house due to the lockdown restrictions, to name a few. One of the recommendations from the assessment was to conduct a women's survey to understand the experiences of women accessing the formal justice system during COVID-19. So FWRM then decided to do all over Fiji and included women living with disabilities and transgender women as well. The findings of this research are as follows. In terms of seeking help, 67% of the respondents approached other persons and organizations before going to the police or courts. And the top two choices for the respondents were family members and or friends. In terms of difficulties experienced in going to the police or the courts, 67% of the women said that they faced difficulties in going to the police and courts. And in terms of challenges they experienced in seeking assistance from police and the courts, they said the top two difficulties which was identified by the women were fear of being physically attacked and fear of what others would say about them seeking assistance from police and the courts. So other challenges experienced by women included physical attack by partner and husband. They did not know where to go. They did not know the court processes. And there was delay in serving the domestic violence restraining orders, or simply being told to resolve these disputes within family or villages rather than being lodge these complaints by the police and family and friends. They also experienced assault, experienced insult, and no one took them seriously. So whilst we had the two top difficulties, these were the other difficulties which women shared. And experiences with the police, the women that managed to present themselves to the police stations expanded on their experiences. While 43% of the respondents were impressed with the services of the police, 31% of the respondents who had went to the police during COVID response period, this is between mid-March to onwards, stated that they did not feel safe at the police station, that the police delayed in serving their domestic violence restraining orders, and the police did not treat them with courtesy and respect while they gave their statements at the station. And the police even tried to act as counselors to get the respondent to reconcile with their partners. And 59% of the respondents stated that police did not take any action regarding their complaint. And 38% said that the respondents basically did not agree that the police listened to what they had to say and even included that in their statement. In terms of accessibility, 18% of the respondents said that they needed assistance to get to the courtroom or the police station if there were stairs. And 69% needed assistance in completing written forms, such as the court forms. Factors which are considered by women when deciding whether to resolve a family issue by going to police or court, respondents were critically concerned, so this is 53% of the women, about their children when deciding whether to go to police or the courts. The other critical considerations included lack of financial means, and this was at 42%, fear of discrimination or victimization, 34%, concern for treatment by police, 32%, and fear of retaliation, again, at 32%. Awareness of medical and legal and counseling service providers out of the women which we had interviewed, majority knew of three common service providers. So these are the Women's Crisis Center, which is a support service provider, the Legal Aid Commission, and the Social Welfare Department. So this is part of the Ministry of Women in Fiji. So in conclusion, that the COVID-19 pandemic has undoubtedly heightened the discrimination faced by women in not only accessing justice, but more specifically the formal justice sector agencies, such as the police and the courts. The fear of being physically attacked or retaliated against and the stigma associated with reporting violence remains at the top of the concerns experienced by victims of gender-based violence. More assurance by the formal justice sector agencies in terms of how it carries out its day-to-day functions would adequately address this concern in Fiji. Also, speedy actions taken by perpetrators would allow more women to approach formal justice sector in reporting gender-based violence. And in conclusion, we would like to say that strengthened collaborative approach by formal justice sector in Fiji together with support services providers would increase the confidence of survivors of violence in accessing justice and prevent future incidences of violence occurring. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Atika. I think from there, it is only fitting that we now, I think, provide this nice segue into the next presentation by Detective Superintendent Paula Hudson, who is from the Australian Federal Police. Paula has spent her 25-year career with AFP combating all forms of human exploitation and community service. And a career highlight for her was implementing an Australian travelling child sex offender intervention strategy across Southeast Asia, which received recognition from the United Nations. But today, we'll be asking her to close off the panel session by contributing to the discussion on the home front. After listening to all our panelists before you, Paula, will you help us round up the discussion by sharing the challenges that law enforcement has had to face during the pandemic in battling domestic violence, and also providing a law enforcement perspective for our better understanding and appreciation of the challenges that you face and also the work that you do. Over to you, Paula.
Thank you, Malati. I appreciate the introduction. And thank you, everybody, for inviting an Australian policing perspective in respect of family and domestic violence, and particularly through the COVID challenges that we've all been facing. In relation to my presentation today, an aspect that I was the aspect of family and domestic violence that I was going to cover off on is one that we have had. It's not as commonly presented as the domestic violence as discussed today. However, it's been a concern for Australian policing jurisdictions in this time, and that is the family violence matters of forced marriage and exit trafficking in Australia. During COVID, we have seen this type of family violence intersecting here in Australia, and it's a very complex form of, family and gender-based violence. What I mean by forced marriage, and in Australia, since 2013, we outlawed forced marriage, and that is a situation where a person is married without freely consenting and due to being coerced, threatened or deceived, or they're incapable of understanding. And also, if you're under the age of 16, it's an absolute offence of forced marriage. Exit trafficking, which is a crime that is we've seen is somewhat related to the forced marriage situation. Trafficking on exit from Australia, we saw a spike in pre-COVID. And typically what that involves is women, young girls being deceived into returning to perhaps their country of ethnicity under the guise of a holiday or to learn some more about their culture. And then once they arrive, that they are married against their will. However, even more since COVID has come, the type of exit trafficking we've found is exit trafficking whereby men want to no longer be married to their wife. And this happens in ages, I'll just clarify that to you, the ages of reports this financial year is between 7 years of age and 32 years of age. So in relation to the exit trafficking of, I guess it's forced divorce, they have deceived, the women have been deceived into returning home pre the pandemic, to spend some time with family, and once they returned home under that guise is that often the family of the husband has been involved in stripping them of their identity documents, their phones, and they find themselves effectively exit trafficked out of Australia. Often what will happen is that the spouse, the husband will apply for immigration here and seek to cancel their visas. And we've had a number of instances now where we need to work to get these victims back to Australia. And through the pandemic, it's been a very challenging experience. Can I say that without our partners, this would not be able to be achieved? Whilst I would say that the AFP is the lead agency in Australia for investigating the crimes of human trafficking, forced marriage, we operate within a very strong architectural framework with other agencies, not only government agencies with the Border Force or Immigration, but really importantly our NGOs, and particularly Anti-Slavery Australia and the Australian Red Cross. We've been working, despite the pandemic, to return victims who've been exit trafficked from Australia, which is at times, as you'd appreciate, been very challenging, but they have been returned, they do the quarantine, and we arrange all that through our partners in that area. Just in relation to moving on to the general statistics, as I said, in Australia the last year it's been 223 reports in the last financial year. That's been pretty consistent over the last 3 or 4 years, but we can say that we've analysed the reports received during COVID at the same time as this time last year, and we received less during the actual lockdowns, but once the restriction has started easing, that reporting is on the increase again. And as I say, we're finding that there's been a number of victims that have been exit trafficked, so we need to get them back. In relation to how do we overcome the legal challenges, Australian typical, I guess, domestic violence orders or apprehension orders that you would normally, the police would normally use for in the home, they don't really provide that flexibility to say, for example, prohibit a marriage from taking place or prevent a person being taken out of or deceived from being taken out of Australia, or to stop them from travelling is, I guess, the key thing. So what we have done to overcome those sort of barriers is to enact our own border alerts. So once we know that someone is at risk, placing border alerts on the airports. We've had a number of cases where we've been, those alerts have gone off, but in particular to young girls, and we attend the airport and we make those interventions and disruptions there. The other big key to helping us overcome our legal challenges is in Australia, we have what is known as the Support for Trafficked Persons Program. Now, that is a program that supports all victims of all types of human trafficking, but in respect of forced marriage, because of recognising the domestic nature of that, it has been decoupled from the criminal justice process. And so what that means is that most people are victims of human trafficking. To be in the Support for Trafficked Persons program, you must participate in the criminal justice process, i.e. that you give evidence as a victim. In respect of forced marriage, you do not have to participate in the criminal justice process. And that's in recognition of most of the offenders are parents, brothers, cousins or elder family members. So these young victims are, it's very unlikely to expect them to participate. In fact, 72% of our forced marriage victims that went on to the Support for Trafficking Persons this year do not proceed to criminal prosecution. And that usually simply is the case. It's their mum and dad that's put them into that situation. So it's a very difficult position. However, we still provide that support to them and monitor them through the program. And just finally to touch on some other prevention efforts that we take in relation to disrupting this type of unique, I guess, almost international family violence type is we have had enacted a program at all Sydney Airport, International Airport, which we are hoping to roll out to all airports called Project Skywarp. And it's an advertising campaign that floods the airports in respect of telling people that they have the right not to be forced to be married. They do not have to leave Australia if you do not want to, if you are leaving against your will. And it's got the appropriate AFP phone numbers, and also Anti-Slavery Australia participate in those programs. Along with the airport campaigns that we have another a program called Look a Little Deeper. And that is a program that's been developed by the AFP for frontline responding people. So even ambulance services, border force, airport staff. And it's a program where we roll that out and train those frontline people into what the indicators are that someone is being forced against their will that could be a victim of human trafficking, and how to refer it and refer that back to the AFP, similar to the recognise, respond, refer process. So I guess that sums up my, sharing my insights, but we thought it was very important that we discussed this particular type of family violence issue that has, come to the fore during COVID and post-COVID lockdowns.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Paula. That really is very illuminating. And this is probably an area which maybe not many of us would have realized, was a particularly challenging one. And for it to surface in COVID just goes to show that when the criminals decide that they want to get into the act, even something like a global pandemic is not going to stop them. I really want to thank all our panelists. We have actually come to the end of the panel session, and I hope that you will agree with me that it has been such an enriching sharing from all of them, from such different perspectives, as well as the different jurisdictions. I'm now going to hand over the time to the organizers for the question and answer segment. This is just to remind everybody that if you wish to take part in the question and answer session, please press the raise hand button so that our admin can admit you into this next session, which is going to be moderated by the Honorable Diana Bryan, who is a non-practicing fellow of the IAFL and also chair of the World Congress on Family Law and Children's Rights, who is also one of the co-organizers of this webinar. So press the raise hand button and you'll then be admitted And please put your video on so that you can ask your question live. And I think, well, all I can say is over to you, Diana.
Thanks, Malati, very much. A couple of questions have come through while we've been going, asking whether or not this will be recorded. So, yes, the session is being recorded, and for those who've got difficulties with their internet connections, you'll be able to watch it again, and for those who simply want to watch it again. We've got a number of questions, so I might just start off by, while we're waiting to see who comes on live, to put some of the questions that we have. This one's for Artika, and the question is, thank you for the comprehensive analysis. What's the number of respondents in your research group?
Hello, everyone. Yes, so the total number of respondents for this research was 33 women. We had put out a call out on social media, and we had advertised for it. And very few women actually came forward, because in Fiji, in the Pacific, like in some other countries as well, sharing of experiences relating to domestic violence is considered a taboo. So not many women would be willing to share these experiences. And in times of COVID, we thought that 33 women were good enough for this research. Thank you.
We have a question then from Helen Matthews, who's from Women's Legal Services in Australia and Victoria. And she says this: our experience in Victoria with two hard lockdown periods since March was initially an increase in separated families with existing family law arrangements needing assistance with COVID-related issues, but a reduction at first in help seeking for family violence from women still living with their partner. This reduction was experienced by family violence services and legal services. Hospital admissions for family violence injuries, police call-outs in response to neighbours increased. She says, we're expecting a post-lockdown increase in family violence support and legal response surge. Are others planning for this? So, Karina, you might want to answer that from the Singapore perspective.
Sure. We didn't see a surge post-lockdown, which I thought we would. We saw it continue to be at a high level. But, you know, I did expect that there would be more people reaching out after the lockdown because they were trapped during the lockdown. But that didn't actually happen. So I think it's, yeah, and maybe because, you know, people are going out and they are actually able to find ways to get out the house and also to get support from their friends and family during this time. Yeah.
Okay. Does anyone else want to comment on that? Anne, what about you?
The statistics in Hong Kong, as the restrictions have been lifted gradually in Hong Kong, the reported incidents of domestic violence are going up. So the Australian experience has been similar to the experience in Hong Kong. One NGO that deals with sexual violence in particular reported that they'd seen a significant drop in reports and posited that that might be because the very nature of sexual violence is one which you would particularly want to keep secret from other members of the family. And if you're living in a multi-generational family home, it would be extremely difficult to find the space to report on that. Similar experience.
So sexual violence in Singapore was interesting. It's actually the opposite. So during COVID, it really reduced, like very, very few cases. And then when that was lifted, we had a big surge, well above what it used to be before the lockdown. So, and it continues to be high. So that has increased post-lockdown.
Okay. What about Ayako? Do you think there's likely to be a surge in Japan in cases when the lockdown finishes? I think you're on mute at the moment.
Yeah.
Still muted.
Sorry. Okay. Yeah, it's hard to tell. Well, we have another serious situations now. So, you know, there will be a surge in near future. But so, you know, in a way, this is not a post-lockdown, but we may have another kind of quasi-lockdown now. So, you know, we cannot tell, you know, post-lockdown or not, you know. So that's the situation in Japan.
What about Fiji? Artika, you're expecting a surge?
Yes, we are expecting a surge. In Fiji, for the period of January to October, I'm leaving out January because in February, there's more than about 300 cases of sexual violence, which has been recorded by the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions. So in times of crisis situation, like all over the world, sexual violence in Fiji too increases. Yeah.
Okay. Good. I've got a question for Paula. The question is, you said the victims of exit trafficking typically don't press for criminal action. What civil penalties and other restraints apply?
Yeah, thank you. Great question. I guess the civil penalties, there's no civil regime in place as yet. We are examining, looking at a system similar to what is in the British system with the Forced Marriage Protection Order regime, but very early days. However, what I would say is that if, especially underage children do not want to participate in a criminal proceeding, we certainly can resort to the domestic violence and apprehended violence order processes. Or alternatively, as I said, some of our other disruption techniques are that we just put a ban on their ability to have a passport to protect them if they're underage to be able to be taken out of the country.
Great. Thanks, Paula. This is a question that's really interesting and probably for everybody. Has there been any significant increase or decrease in gender-based violence during the COVID pandemic? For example, female on male as compared to male on female, same-sex violence. Who'd like to answer that? Maybe Anne, have you got any evidence from your research on that?
I'm afraid the answer is no, we don't have any evidence, because all we know that there's a general drop in stats. One of the NGOs in Hong Kong, when I was conducting the research for this talk, said that she thought we may never have a clear picture of what had happened widely during the pandemic in relation to violence, and specifically in terms of disaggregated data, because she thought that the government wasn't keeping that kind, weren't keeping those kinds of records. And that goes back to a real problem in Hong Kong with data collection and disaggregation. So unfortunately, no, don't have that information.
Okay. Karina, anything in Singapore? Have you got any data that might shed light on that?
Yeah, we don't have data on this, but what I know from the LGBT groups is that LGBT people were facing a more difficult time at home because they were, many of them lived with their parents in Singapore. And, you know, while they used to be able to have, to hang out with friends and to get away from their homes, which they found oppressive, they went out to their parents, etc., or their parents didn't accept them. This was no longer available. So I know that the lockdown was very difficult on those groups. I don't know whether there was an increase in violence. I've not heard that there is.
Okay. Arjika, anything to report from Fiji on that?
Yes. So for us, the data which we have is from the Fiji judiciary. And for the year 2020, from January to May, a total of 1,744 DVRO applications were initiated, with women being 64% of the applicants. And in the family division of the magistrate's court, A total of 128 DVROs were initiated, and 68% were initiated by women. So with the lack of data from the Fiji police force and these data which we have from the Fiji judiciary, it can be safe to say that majority of the victims and survivors in domestic violence situation for this year are women.
Okay. Ayako, do you have any stats in Japan?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any such statistics. So, you know, I think it's very difficult for me to tell anything about that.
All right. Well, that was a very interesting question. We've got a question which I think is related to the UK. So this might be one for you, Anne. Someone who says England's back in lockdown now, as we've seen, and likely to face regional restrictions and local lockdowns for some time. Is there any particular form of support or intervention that you found worked well during periods of lockdown? And I guess perhaps you can all answer that then if you want to. But it's an English interlocutor, so.
The measures that have been taken by the UK government have been one of a coordinated response across departments. There was a paper released in advance or at the very beginning of the lockdown period setting out their strategies. And one of the measures that seems to have been of use was the safe space reporting. So one of the few places during the first lockdown and now also in the second lockdown that you are able to go to is the pharmacy. And so one of the measures that was set up was that victims, if seeking help, if they were not able to pick up the phone at home, could go to the pharmacy on some, you know, seemingly legitimate business and say, use a phrase, speak to the pharmacist and access help in that way. So that's been one of the interesting innovations during lockdown.
Thank you. We've got a question here about child protection, which says much child protection depends upon children being visible, for example, to schools. Are any of the panellists aware of any initiatives during lockdown to ensure appropriate surveillance of children at risk of harm? Who'd like to answer that one? Corinna?
I'm not aware of anything, actually. Yeah, but it's a good point.
Mm.
Yeah.
And anything that you're aware of?
In Hong Kong, the Education Bureau has, the reporting is that the Education Bureau has been working with the Social Welfare Department to ensure that children that they already knew were at risk, there would be some form of contact maintained with them. Visits, however, home visits were not available at the time, and the worry was that children would become invisible through the absence of a home visit. Also that children, by not being in school, wouldn't have the chance to talk to safe adults that they would normally confide in. However, the Education Bureau has been very keen to emphasise that it is taking note of children who are not attending online schools, and that will be a trigger for inquiries into their safety.
Does anyone else like to add to that?
In Fiji, we don't necessarily have a particular initiative for children during COVID-19. However, we already had an existing child helpline, and this was being accessed during the lockdown and is still being accessed. However, data from this is not available. So unfortunately, I won't be able to share further information on that.
Okay, thank you for that. Now, that's the, I think I've got to the end of the questions that we have here on the Q&A. Does anyone else want to raise a question? Any of TL, do you like to, or anyone else have a
question? Yeah, thanks. I'm just technically challenged, so I was just trying to attempt typing in the question, but it wasn't very successful. So let me just ask a question, if I may, to the panel. generally for everyone, that, well, with the COVID, right, unfortunately, no one sort of anticipated the surge in domestic violence and sexual violence and gender abuse, right? So just trying to look forward into the crystal ball beyond 2020 into 2021 or 2022, right? Even when the vaccines come about, hopefully, to some good news. What do you all anticipate, right, will happen moving forward into the future, right? Will it be less of what we now have, more of the same, or perhaps even something different, right, that may surface into the future? I just thought every one of you could share your experience and your expertise. Thank you.
Why don't we start with Ayako? Do you want to start off with that one?
Yeah, I mean, I think, government as well as, you know, those people concerned with these issues are aware of the matter. I mean, the family, I mean, that domestic violence. And, you know, they increased support and, you know, as well as, I hope that they will fund more. And so I think, you know, generally the issues will be improved. That's my hope.
Karina, what about you?
My sense is that 2021 is going to be a challenging year for the world, just economically speaking. And, you know, we will see even more job losses and more companies close down, be in trouble. And I think that just sort of puts a lot of stress on families, right? So I'm not so sure that it's going to be, I think it might be worse as time goes on. I agree with Ayako that there are more solutions today than before COVID, for example, you know, like companies being a part of the solution. So, and we have seen governments also step up. There's a national hotline. There are also, I think, more public education programs to tell people where they can go for help. But yeah, I think that it's actually going to continue to be a problem. Domestic violence is going to continue to be a problem more so than it used to be before COVID.
What about you, Anne? What's the Hong Kong prognosis?
There's been more coverage in the press, in the local Hong Kong press, about domestic violence than there has been in previous years, certainly in the last 16 years. The last time there was a lot of coverage was 2004, when there was a tragic family death, mother and two children killed while trying to leave the husband. So there's been a lot more coverage, which is a good thing. It's raising awareness, which I think is a problem in Hong Kong. We need to get discussion of family violence much more out in the open. It's currently a very, very private matter. The problem I foresee will be in NGO funding. A few NGOs are already reporting much diminished levels of funding because the big charity events haven't been able to take place, which of course will impact on the work that they're able to do. We have proposals for legislation on the books at the moment in Hong Kong to make it an offence to allow for someone to allow the death of a child or vulnerable person as a result of neglect that they were aware of. I worry that some of the legislation that could help will be more delayed because of slowing down of legislative procedures. Although Hong Kong has its own very particular issues around the legislative processes at the moment. But I worry that everything's going to be slowed down, that funding will be cut, and that people who need the help will be less able to get it. So what I'd like to see is lawyers and the legal professional bodies and the judiciary, Department of Justice, stepping up and sending out heightened messaging that there is still help available, and that, you know, this is an offence and you can go the criminal route, you can go the civil route, and that there are resources still.
Thanks, Anne. Artika? Anything you'd like to say on that?
A bit about Fiji. We are in the Pacific. We are prone to cyclones and we are heavily reliant on tourism. So with the COVID, what has happened is that the borders are closed. The tourism industry is being affected. A number of people have lost their jobs. So those are some of the contributing factors. And the longer the borders remain closed, situation is bound to get worse. And November to April for Fiji is our cyclone period. So apart from just COVID-19, we have natural disasters as well to look out for in terms of, unfortunately, increasing violence against women and girls.
Okay, thank you. Well, I don't have any further questions from the participants. Malati.
I have a question for Corina because, you know, we're talking about COVID and the implications on the economy. And I just wanted to ask her about AWARE's experience with the companies and employers when they did the outreach on the prevention and management of domestic violence, you know, from a sort of work from home or even, you know, within the office. Did they appreciate the intangible value that such risk prevention or management strategies to cope with domestic violence would bring to them as employers? Or did they, you know, take the view that old archaic view that many people used to have, that domestic violence was a private matter and it was actually, you know, things that people needed to sort out on their own at home? I just wanted to get the sense of it from you.
Well, of course, when we are invited to do these talks and workshops, these are the people who have accepted the idea that it is a workplace issue. These companies are companies that often have their MNCs. I haven't actually done any workshops for companies that are locally based, but yeah, often it is that the parent company somewhere else has actually started this, or if that's not the case, then it is there's an MNT and they have an independent movement here. So you know, we're talking about maybe about 15 companies, so it's a start. We were hoping to get a grant to try to use this momentum to get many other companies to actually adopt this and see that it. Now, I can tell you that the employees are very appreciative. Even if they're not in these situations, they are appreciative that the company cares for them, right? That this is a way that the company feels they can actually add value and support the employees. And it goes a long way with the employees. So I think there's now a lot more focus on the mental well-being, the well-being of the employees. So I think this will continue. I just hope that, you know, we gain enough of a momentum that it becomes a norm. And from AWARE as an advocacy group, we would like to see this, because one of the things that stopped Singapore from signing a convention, an ILO convention, was a convention on workplace and violence and gender violence. One of the things that stopped Singapore was this thing that, the convention required companies to have this policy, right, to have a policy on family violence. And Singapore said, well, that is not our norm, so we can't sign this convention. So hopefully we get to see enough take up that the government says, okay, you know, we can sign and we will encourage companies to have this. This would be a very good outcome.
Nigel, I know that you're aware of the position in Australia in the workers' compensation sphere. So do you just want to say something about that?
I'm not very aware of it, but I know that we've had a recent case which has actually required us as employers to take into account the situation of our employees at home, and that we are liable for those employees if something were to happen, and therefore we need to have policies in place to be able to deal with any domestic violence situation that comes up while they are at home doing their work on our behalf. So that's certainly the position in New South Wales. I'm not sure whether that is Australia-wide or not at this stage.
So it's a compensable injury, in other words. So.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, so good.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. If you can share that case, that would be great. That's helpful, I think, to push this forward.
Thank you. Okay. All right. Our timing's about right, so if we have no other questions from the panel, I'll hand back to you, Corinne, or Alati, who's going to wind up.
I think that may actually be me.
Right.
Yes, so it's my honour as what has been described the midwife of this little organisation and session tonight to actually thank all of our panellists. Before I do that, if I may, can I thank some individuals from our respective organisation? It's been an amazing event, and I think the first time that our three organisations have come together, as Corinne said right at the beginning, with very similar goals, with very similar memberships, and it's fantastic to see that we are all presenting. From Law Asia, can I thank TL and Malati for your participation in doing this. Malati, I think you have more hats than just from Law Asia at this stage, but thank you for your job in moderating today. From World Congress on Family Law and Children's Rights, Sally, thank you very much for your participation in doing that. And again, I'm very pleased to see the World Congress working with IAFL and Law Asia. Diana, I think you're wearing several hats tonight as well, so thank you for that. From IAFL, thank you to our administrative people behind the scenes, Ali, Daphne and Donna. It has been a fairly major exercise getting this all working, but thank you for that as well. Corinne is our indefatigable president. Thank you very much for the work you've done, and Jeff as well, in getting this happening. Can I turn, though, to our panellists themselves? This function was to coincide on November 25th with the International Day of Elimination of Violence Against Women. I think it's shocking that we have to have such an international day. I look forward to the day where we don't have that. But thank you not only for your participation tonight and bringing such valuable and diverse insights to the session tonight, but thank you for all the work that you do in your own ways in making the elimination of violence against women a reality. We have a way to go. It's a slightly sobering topic that we're talking about, but thank you. And Paula, thank you for the topic that you raised. I could see a whole new topic, and now we know where you are, so we will be calling on you again. But thank you all for your participation tonight. Last but not least, thank you all as the audience, who we haven't really been able to see, but I can see that there are still more than 80 of you, and I think we had 130 of you during the course of the evening. So thank you very much for participating tonight.